Welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. I'm Jeffrey Higgins. This is my wife Cynthia's in my restaurant. We've turned it into a literary hub in the DC area. You are the 172nd author that I've interviewed since we've opened. It's always my pleasure to be able to chat with other creatives. I like it so much.
I'm so honored. 172. Another 100 years and I'll be that age. You know?
We're recording this for our podcast as well. And so we're number right now 2 on Spotify and number 3 on Apple for a literary salon. So do check us out. If you go to elainesliterarysalon.com, you can find our website and our newsletter sign up. I think it goes out about once a month just to give you an update on who's coming. We do at least 1 a week, sometimes up to 4 a week. So it's really a lot of fun. So today, I'm looking forward to chatting with you. We have so much to talk about. Elizabeth Bruce is an award-winning author, educator, and arts producer. Her recent collection, Universally Adored and Other $1 Stories, was published by Vine Leaves Press in 2024 and won 3 indie fiction distinctions. Her debut novel, In Silent Left the Place, won Washington Writers Publishing House's Fiction Prize, a Forward Magazine Bronze Prize, and the Texas Institute of Letters Finalist Award. It's also available as an author-read audiobook, which I definitely want to talk to you about because that is incredibly difficult. She's been published in the USA and 12 other countries. A native Texan, she's currently shopping around her new novel, I Will Read Ashes For You, the deep backstory of the 1947 Texas City disaster in which a friendship full of ammonium nitrate fertilizer blew up in the port of Texas City. It remains the deadliest industrial accident in U.S. history. Elizabeth is a former character actor and co-founder of DC's Sanctuary Theater and creator of the Theatrical Journey Project, introducing science to early learners through a guided pretend play at Centronia. With her husband, all-round creativist Robert Michael Oliver, she co-hosts Creativists in Dialogue, a podcast embracing the creative life on Substack. She's a proud mama of 2 amazing adult children and has 1 fabulous granddaughter and granddoggie. She's super excited to be here, and we're thrilled to have her. So please welcome Elizabeth Bruce.
Thank you, Jeff.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You are doing so much stuff. So
So are you, my friend.
That's right. That's why I'm looking forward to this, because it's really fun. I want to know how you're doing it all, because that's really fascinating. Let's start with In Silent Left the Place. This was your debut novel. Why don't you just give us a little back jacket copy, tell us what it's about without any spoilers.
Sure. So In Silent Left the Place, I'm a native Texan, as Jeff said, and it's set in South Texas in the desert in South Texas in April of 1963, and the main character is an 81-year-old World War I veteran who came back from the Great War middle-aged and silent. He can speak, but he doesn't speak. So the mystery of the novel is, why doesn't Thomas Riley speak? And the reader does find out, but not until late in the book.
I mean, so this came out in, 2015, is that correct?
Well, it was originally published by Washington Writers Publishing House in, I think, 2007. But I have remained active with the press, which celebrated 50 years of continuous operation.
Congratulations.
In 2025.
That's huge.
Yes, I haven't been there all 50 years. But it was reissued in 2021. And then the author read, I read the audiobook, and that came out in 2024, I think.
You know, that's one of the things that I think authors don't realize. You know, when a book comes out, it's out there forever. I mean, books go out of print, but in the digital age, they really don't. So they're sort of out there forever. It's interesting, right, that you keep having attention and people are still talking about it. How does that feel as, like, legacy, like when you're writing a book that just is out there forever?
Oh, well, you know, I applaud the literary world for coming up with this rather innovative production process called print on demand so that books don't actually go out of print, assuming your publisher doesn't go defunct. But it's great because, you know, writing a novel is like having another whole secret family. I mean, you live with your characters for so long, you become so close to them, they are absolutely real to you. And to be able to share them and put them out in the world and have people connect with them over, you know, weeks and months and years and decades even, it's just thrilling.
So you've written this a while ago. Do you remember the one question that all authors hate is, like, where'd you get the idea, right, for the thing? But I'm always curious, like, how a story comes to people. Do you remember what ignited the story for you?
Well, actually, I had a first draft. I had 300-plus pages of a first draft that was really a coming-of-age story. And it focused more on this young couple who are in this novel. But there's a young couple passing through this part of Texas. and they trespass on a wealthy rancher's land, and the young man is arrested, and the young woman runs off into the desert. So I was really writing that young couple's story, and it was more set more in the 60s, and it was more about the anti-war movement and all of these ever-expanding kind of thematic elements. But I realized that it was getting too symphonic for me, and I didn't have the skill. So I put it aside and picked this character, Thomas Riley, this old man who was a marginal character. He was just on the landscape, runs a gas station out in the desert of South Texas. And I said, okay, I'm gonna write this guy's story. So I did. I put all the coming of age stuff aside, and I went and studied up on this fellow who's very loosely based on my maternal grandfather, who was a World War I veteran and a very quiet but not completely silent man.
That's so interesting. I want to back up to this where you realize it was symphonic and beyond your abilities at the time. And I mean, so many writers will have these big ideas when they first want to write, and they don't realize how many layers of skill are necessary to actually get a book across the finish line. I think it's unusual for someone to kind of have that epiphany as they're writing and then to hold on to it and say, I'm going to come back to this because it's tough, right? So what was it that led you to realize that you probably needed to do this a little longer before you could tackle it?
Well, actually, I was walking down the Boulder Mall. I used to live in Colorado, and I was walking down the Boulder Mall with an old friend, now deceased, who had been my life insurance salesman back when I was a 20-something, and he was my parents' generation. He was somebody I'd befriended, and we would chat, and he was sort of a confidant. So I was telling him about the plot of this first draft, and he goes, oh, it's about you and your mother. And I went, oh, no. Oh, no, I'm too transparent. It's too autobiographical. I went, I can't be this middle-aged woman writing about my misspent youth. You know? So that was a wake-up call. So I realized also that I hadn't even finished. There were just layers and layers that I still hadn't gotten to. And now, at many years later, going back and revisiting some of those pages, I'm really grateful to myself that I did put it aside because it wasn't ready. It was just too, the language was too flowery. There were too many plots and subplots and things like that. So I did myself a real solid by putting it aside.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. I think a lot of people don't do that. And that's why a lot of times their first books don't go anywhere. They don't find a home because they maybe bit off a little too much. So when you're talking about like the theme, oh, this is about you and your mother, when you're going into the book, do you have like something you want to say? Is that why you're writing it? Like this book in particular, something you wanted to say? Or does the theme evolve just out of things you believe in?
Well, actually, this book, as I said, I came from the 1950s and 60s Texas, and it was the segregated South. So the jumping off place for me in this book really was about the sort of moral crime of that era and of this country's moral crime in terms of racial violence and racial injustice. And I felt that I needed to speak to it in a mythic capacity, and hence I... Through my character, Thomas Riley, the silence that he imposes on himself is associated with some of that history. And I was striving to write a very almost parable-like story that had mythic elements and a kind of symbolic underbelly that really dealt with that. So that kind of comes out of my upbringing as a very privileged white kid in the segregated South in the 50s.
And do you find that other themes like emerge because they come out of just who you are as you're writing without you noticing? Like, have you ever finished a work and then go, oh, like, and seen like a common theme through things or something that you hadn't intentionally planned to put that in there, but it came out?
Oh, well, there are lots of moments in this book and other books that come out of real life experiences. There is also a rather theatrical, very theatrical quality to this book. As you know, I was a theater person for many years, and there are some wildly theatrical moments in this book and other books that I could never produce on stage without a $4 million budget. So I was able to put some very theatrical things. There's a bulldozer ballet in this novel. I could never put that on stage. That would be too expensive. And there's a kind of tall Texas tale quality to this book. That there is a tall Texas tale that begins the novel, and you come back to that in the end of the novel. So that comes out of my upbringing as a, you know, small town girl from Texas with a Texas daddy who's a great storyteller.
So how does like that cult, that Texan culture in a small town, how does that become like character in your book, and how would somebody who's not from Texas like relate to that?
Oh, well, small town people are my people. I mean, even though I left a long, long time ago, but they're just regular people. I mean, they're people who have dignity and kind of hopes and dreams and things, and really laborious efforts to sort of move forward in life. I think that the novel is set in a very bare and very harsh part of Texas, and the land is really a character in this book because it is so unforgiving. There's an unforgiving quality to the terrain, and it holds stories. The land holds stories, and there are stories embedded in the land in this novel as well.
I love that. So I guess, like, if I'm looking, say, take a small town in, I don't know, like the Pacific Northwest or Maine or Florida compared to, like, a small Texas town, right? Cultures are different. The lens through which the people who live there view things is different. So when you have characters that are from there and you intimately know the culture and they're seeing things, do you have to go a little farther than you would if you were just, like, sharing this book with people in that region to explain why? Because some of the perceptions probably are not something somebody else would jump to right away, right? And do you have to go a little farther to explain it for a broader audience?
Well, you know, I think that's such a good question, and it really is pivotal to everything I write, because there are lots of presumptions, there are a lot of negative associations with small town life, there are negative associations with Texas or the South or the Southwest, you know, negative associations with parts of our history and eras in you know, the recent past. And my goal as a writer is to humanize the people who are living in these places and to give their struggles a kind of density and a kind of dignity and a kind of complexity that I think is often not assumed, is often kind of disappeared. So people in my books are not necessarily, they're not intellectuals. There's not a lot of neurotic interior thought. You know? But there is interior thought. It's just very plain spoken. Mm-hmm. So the plain spokenness is a part of what I'm trying to capture. And there's a lyricism and a poetry mm-hmm. to it, but it isn't fancy language.
Even though you grew up in this area, you know, and understand it, did you, going back to write this novel years later, did you have to do a lot of research, or did most of it come out of your memory?
Oh, well, I did a lot of research about World War One. I did a lot of research about the Vietnam era for draft one, but there is still a Vietnam dimension to the second novel, this novel. So I did mostly research about World War One, and my character is traumatized. He's a deeply traumatized human being. I didn't write from a medical perspective. I didn't write from a clinical analysis of PTSD or shell shock or battle fatigue or anything. But I did a lot of research into some of the flora and fauna and some of the environmental elements and some of the technology. I had to make sure that things that I had in this novel that had technical elements were authentic. And, you know, when did cars get car radios, for example? They did not have car radios in 1963, and I had to make sure I didn't put a car radio where it didn't belong.
And how do you handle the language, like with jargon or tech or just the language in general has changed so much, right? How are you completely authentic in the way you're portraying it, or do you allow yourself a little bit more just to make it easier to read for, like, people who are, you know, young people today, for example?
Well, you know, I don't write in, I mean, I write in the vernacular, and really my work is designed to be heard more than to be read. So I tell people that you have to read it aloud in your head with a Texas accent. And so the audiobook, of course, is really written in a Texas accent because I go right back into it. I go right back into it, you know, even though I had a Yankee mama and I'm not really a full-blood Texan, and I was kind of pummeled into losing my Texas accent when I left the state, But that is the easy part, frankly. I mean, finding voice. These are very... The culture of Texas and the places that I write about have so much voice. They are so... they're such oral tradition places. And so that is not a problem. Tapping into that kind of oral eloquence and the sort of storytelling ethos and history is the fun part.
Where is the line when you're writing like accents to make it still readable yet authentic, right? Do you do more at the beginning and then ease off of it a little so that voice is already established in the reader's head, or what's the strategy?
Yeah, I mean, I think writing, you know, it's sort of almost a patois. I mean, you know, you use a lot of short words and short sentences, and there's a cadence to it. It's really about the cadence. I mean, I've had people point out that I end up writing in iambic pentameter. I don't mean to do that. It just, you know, there's an intentional cadence. Yep. So there are extra words where you wouldn't necessarily need that word. I mean, I use a lot of slang and a lot of, idioms and expressions and images and such. But I don't write, you know, it's not indecipherable. It's not Nora Zeal Hurston, or I'm not writing, it's not even like reading Faulkner or anything. It's pretty easy to read, I think.
So it's literary fiction, and your prose is beautiful, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
So where is that, I guess, line where it becomes literary fiction? Like, what are the elements that you're looking for to classify it as that? Or do you not care? You're writing with your voice and what you want to write, and then let other people categorize it themselves.
Well, you know, I mean, this is a big conversation that I'm sure you've had many times. What's literary? What's commercial? What's upmarket? There are all these categories in the fiction and literary world. The kind of default explanation is that literary fiction is more character-driven than action-driven. Plot is less important, and you have a lot more interiority, and it's a lot more about the emotional lives of the characters and such. And I get into that, you know? And there is action in what I'm writing. I mean, this thing is 24 hours long, and a lot happens in those 24 hours. But for me, I think it really has to do with a sense of place, you know, and people who are rooted in a sense of place, and voice, you know? There's a lot of dialogue, and there's a lot of trying to capture the sort of the kind of vibe of a place, the sort of personality of a place.
Yeah, for me, when I'm reading it, it's your voice, your arthurial voice, but it's also the beauty of the prose. I think those are the two things that kind of elevate it above some other commercial fiction, for example. So I'm curious, you said you base this loosely on a relative. What is that character creation like? Because it's so different for everybody else. Do these characters, I guess, come to you like somewhat fully formed, or are you more methodical in the way that you're crafting them before you start writing?
Yeah, I mean, characters do come to you. I mean, they it's a visitation, really. I mean, it is a kind of psychological state.
I love that.
It's a visitation. Yeah. You know, y'all come on down. You know, yeah. You are visited with this character, and then they are in your consciousness in that kind of liminal space. I mean, I was still raising kids, and still had kids at home when I was working on the first draft of this novel. So I would spend that liminal time before everybody got up and before I fell asleep, sort of trying to puzzle through internal issues and thematic issues and plot points, you know. Not to be flip, but in some ways it's kind of like having an affair. You know, you've got this other person on your mind all the time that nobody else knows about, you know? So it is a little bit like that. It's like having these other, you know, this other family that you're attending to, who isn't visible to anybody else. So
it's like having your foot in two different worlds, right?
Right.
And when you talk to people about a work when you're in the middle of it, do they look at you funny? Like, do the people around you, your support system, do they understand what you're doing and what you're going through, or do they feel like this? You know, you're off someplace else when they're trying to talk to you.
Well, actually, I mean, I think the sort of foundational building block of the writing life is in part the writing group. You know, to have a writer's group of fellow writers, a peer writing group. A good friend of mine who's a psychotherapist, I was visiting with her some years ago, and I was telling her about my writing group, and she goes, oh, it's like staffing. And I went, well, what is staffing? And she goes, well, in a clinical practice, and you have different practitioners, and somebody's going to be out of town, you have a little staff session where you bring your fellow clinicians up to date on client A, B, or C, and what their issues are, and so that somebody can cover for you. So she said that the writer's group is like staffing for your characters, because you get a lot of your peer writers to weigh in on this character or that character, and whether that works or doesn't work, or whether they would do that, or oh no, you can't let that person do that. Don't kill them off, you know, or something like that.
So when you're in a writing group, so these are really alpha readers, right? Because it's a work in progress. At what point do you know to trust the feedback you're getting?
Oh, another good question. I mean, boy, that, you know, I've had people make suggestions to me that I just had to reject because it was just too radical a shift. I'm very lucky because I'm married to a writer, a really great guy sitting right over there, and so he gets to be kind of my sounding board and my own therapist for my own characters.
When you're writing, are you thinking, what would he think of this? Are you writing for him? Is he like your first reader?
Oh no, I'm not writing for him. I don't think I could ever claim that. But you know, there is a certain. You know, do things make sense? Is there a larger sort of structural firmness and a kind of structural legitimacy? My husband has an X-ray vision for structure, and I do not. You know, I get associative, and I go off on this tangent or that tangent, so I'm kind of the queen of backstory, so I'm always, like, building more backstory, and sometimes that backstory has to really fit into this larger structure, and I sometimes struggle with that.
Do you find yourself using the backstory to get to know your characters better and see how it influences plot, and then later cutting it out, or does most of it find its way into your final work?
That's a great question. I mean, it is kind of like, as you know, I was an actor before I was a writer, and so actors build all of this backstory. You know, you have a character, and you only know, you know, a little teeny bit about your character from what's in the script, so you have to fill in all these gaps, and people write long backstory, you know, descriptions. So I find the backstory is incredibly useful to filling in the gaps and just creating kind of texture and density and a complexity to a character. It's really hard to have to kill off your backstory because you can't get it all in there. But it's also a great way to just create just more layers of what's happening and to explain why the present action has this thing or that thing happening, because there's history there. There's a lot of complexity that goes back to character A or B.
So where is that moment when you realize you're putting in too much backstory and you can't get to it? Like is there a formula that you use in your head, or is it just an instinct, or is it a pacing issue? What drives that, I can't get this in?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's all of the above. I mean, this novel that I just finished and I'm shopping around has a lot of backstory, and it's a much longer novel. And, you know, sometimes there are practical considerations, like, you know, you're losing the momentum, or you're going on too long. So, you know, feedback from other writers, from your writing group, if you're in some kind of structured learning environment, that kind of feedback is really useful. Or if it's just a distraction, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a judgment call. It really is a judgment call, and you have to be somewhat dispassionate about it.
So your second book, it's a collection of short stories. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's called "An Universally Adored and Other $1 Stories," published by Vine Leaves Press, which is an Athens-based literary press, in 2024. It is a collection of 33 short fictions, each of which begins with the words $1. So a wonderful former instructor of mine, John McNally, called it, likened it to 33 ways of looking at the blackbird. It's sort of 33 ways of looking at a dollar. So they're very short. Most of them are flash fictions, some longer stories, but they're, you know, what is the meaning of a dollar? What can a dollar do in situation A, B, or C? So it's a pretty fun read. There's a few serious stories.
It sort of sounds like an anthology call with a prompt. Where did this come from? How did you come up with it?
You know, I think what happened was I used to anchor a series called Writers on the Green Line, which was a free intergenerational community-based writing workshop. And lots of people would come and facilitate workshops. And there was a workshop that was facilitated once in which I wrote a story that began with a dollar. I think it was one of the stories in here called Ricky Steiner Was Supposed to Die in Prison. And I got really good response to that story. So I just, you know, started writing other dollar stories. It was just a little sort of writing exercise that I imposed upon myself. And then I ended up with a whole bunch of dollar stories. And we did a production of nine of these stories. We did a prose and performance production. Michael and I took the actual prose text and chopped it up into a script exactly as written, with focal characters and objective narrators and subjective narrators. It was really great. We did it at the Fringe a few years ago.
That sounds like so much fun. We should do that here.
You should.
That really sounds like fun. So the prose in this one is beautiful as well. And it kind of reminds me of, like, a lot of people when they write free verse poetry. I feel like this is what they're writing, right? It's prose, but it's gorgeous, and it has a rhythm to it and a music to the words. When you're writing this, what are you doing with each story, like, individually? Like, what is the reader supposed to feel?
Well, again, these are short stories, each of which, many of which come out of personal experiences, but they're a focal character who's in some kind of situation. You know, it's a 12-year-old kid who lost his Metro card and he's got to panhandle a dollar. It's, you know, a young woman running from an abusive ex who goes to a cheap motel and they have one of those bed vibrators called Magic Fingers. You know, she finally plunks in four quarters and gets one of those bed massages. You know, other kinds of, you know, a busking jazz musician. I mean, just how can a dollar be pivotal? Again, it's written very much in a cadence. There's a number of stories that are set either in Texas or in the Gulf Coast or in the South or the West. So once again, I always, not always, but I frequently come back to the sort of rhythms of speech. And then I try to bring the story, you know, the story's got to have a punchline. I mean, there's some pivot point, and then I try to open with the dollar and I try to close with the dollar. So there's a little bit more of a structural formula there.
Is there an idea or a philosophy or something that you're trying to impart in the work as a whole?
Yeah, just that, you know, small details matter. I mean, a dollar is ubiquitous. I mean, there's a story called Universally Adored in which an artist is trying to win her girlfriend back, and so she spends all night creating a facsimile of a dollar, and because the dollar is universally adored, and the issues with the girlfriend had to do with money and stuff like that. So I am sort of reflecting on this. I mean, what could be more American than the Yankee sawbuck, you know, the $1? It is so foundational. I have a story about it. It's actually embedded in the amygdala, you know, the recognition of a dollar in a sort of bleak and desolate landscape. So it is really the intimate detail. That's what the dollar is. It's an intimate detail for lots of little stories about lots of different kinds of people.
So clever. So writing short is incredibly different than the long form, right? Which do you prefer?
Well, having just written a 400-page novel, maybe I'd prefer the longer form. But actually, I do prefer the short form. Even things that I've written in novels are kind of chopped up into these very compressed, very sparely written, often mini stories, whether it's a chapter of a larger story or whether it's an actual completed flash fiction or short story. So I think I probably prefer the shorter form.
So let's talk about your new book.
Okay.
What's it about?
You're talking about the one that has...
The manuscript. To be, that will find a home soon.
Oh, yes, I'm shopping it out, you know, so any publishers out there interested. It is called I Will Read Ashes For You, which comes from a poem by... I'll come back to that. Sandberg, Carl Sandberg. It is set in 1980 in the little petrochemical town of Texas City, which is right next to my hometown of Lamarck, Texas. And the deep backstory of the manuscript is the 1947 Texas City disaster, in which a French ship full of ammonium nitrate fertilizer caught fire and blew up in the port of Texas City. And then there were a cascade of other explosions, and it was devastating. It killed at least 600 and mutilated 3,500 others. It is still the deadliest industrial accident in U.S. history, and until 9/11, it was the deadliest loss of firefighter lives. 27 of the 28 members of the Texas City Volunteer Fire Department were just vaporized. It's a horrible, horrible accident. Complicated backstory. And yet it was legendary growing up. I mean, it was before my time, but my mother was a nurse and she was part of the triage. And so this terrible tragedy, terrible disaster really shaped that part of the world. I mean, the city was destroyed. They had to completely rebuild. So I wanted to revisit that. I actually take about 10 characters from my dollar stories and put them together in a fictitious diner that rose out of the ashes of this terrible disaster. So readers of this new novel will maybe recognize some characters from the dollar stories. But it was really about a small town rising from the ashes, having to rebuild and finding some respite in just the bonds of community.
How does like that major trauma like get passed down generationally? Like I'm sure you grew up with the stories, and you said it changed the physical landscape as well. Right. How does that affect like the psyche of people? You know, 50 years later, for example.
Well, you know, I think, there were people whose families were personally touched. I have classmates who lost uncles or aunts or other relatives. So the personal pain is there. I think the fact that it was so devastating and yet the governmental response to it was so inadequate. It's a longer story and I can't really describe all the legal details, but they never really got any money out of this terrible disaster. It did change workplace safety issues. It changed the ways in which these toxic and explosive chemicals were treated. But I also think my understanding is that because it was such a horrible disaster, the town pulled together in ways that the segregated South was not known for pulling together. So there is a kind of community-mindedness and a kind of rising beyond the sort of bigotry and all of the layers of discrimination that the segregated South is known for. And people were pretty much in the same boat. I mean, even in my little town, there were some people who were better off than others. There was some income disparity, but it wasn't like there were wealthy, really wealthy people and really poor people. So it was a pretty consistent economic cohort of folks.
When you're writing about a real incident that took real life, how much of an obligation do you feel to be, you know, true to the facts, and how much literary license do you give yourself to change things for your plot and character?
Well, this is why I write fiction, because I'm not a journalist. I don't consider this manuscript historical fiction, even though it's based on an historical element, and I don't have any real people referenced in it. It is truly an imagined sort of journey from devastation to recovery. So there is a kind of mythic element to it. You know, I've been away from Texas for a long time, but I tend to perceive of it in kind of mythic capacities. So I am not trying to instruct the reader on historical facts. I leave the historical descriptions to nonfiction writers. So I'm hoping when it's published I don't get a lot of blowback and say, well, it wasn't like that. You know, you got this detail or that detail wrong. But I have done a lot of research into some of the physical landscape and some of the you know, plot points that happen. But it is definitely a work of fiction.
Did you go back to the area when you wrote this book?
Well, I have been back, and we're going to go back again this summer. I have a sister who still lives in my hometown with her husband, and I have a couple of relatives who live in the Houston area. And I'm back in touch with a bunch of my classmates from the Lamarck High School class of 1970. But I haven't, you know, I haven't spent an extended period of time at the physical place that the book is set in.
When you go back as an adult, do you see things that you had a certain impression of, which now you look at very differently? Like, are there moments when you have these kind of aha moments because you have such a broader perspective now?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, the landscape is, it's much more developed in many ways, and you know, there's just highways and concrete everywhere now, but it's the wetlands, you know, it's the Gulf Coast, and there's an incredible beauty to the landscape. Obviously, the dangers and the perils of that kind of petrochemical industry are very present still. I mean, I'm very keenly aware, and indeed in this manuscript I'm writing, cancer is epidemic. In 1980, it is still epidemic. So many classmates have died. So there's a certain just ongoing tragedy about how the environmental impact of this world that we live in and what it takes to keep it kind of roaring along. The people of this area are part of who take the brunt of that.
And you said this is on submission now, or are you looking for an agent, or are you going directly to publishers?
Well,
what's the strategy?
I would love an agent. That's a whole long journey. I'm aware that this is literary fiction, and agents really want fiction that is going to, like your books, that are going to fly off the shelf and make them some money. So I think what I'm going to do is leapfrog over the agent and go straight to small presses and publishers.
I mean, there is a market for elevated fiction, you know, and yours certainly is elevated. You know, I could see this finding a wide audience.
I hope so. It is, it's a part of, you know, there is the historical piece that people don't know anything about. I have almost never met anybody in this area who's ever heard of a Texas City disaster. I mean, people from that area know all about it, but it's completely invisible to anybody else. And I think that, you know, the fact that my characters are, in many ways, it's such a hopeful story. I mean, people have had hard lives, and there's a lot of pain in the people who gather in this diner and the diner owners, and so there's a lot of hardship, and people have had a lot of hard losses, but they come together, and there's a certain beauty to the connections and to the commitments that people have with each other. So I think there's a very beautiful story of resilience, and I think there's definitely people want to read loving and intimate portrayals of just regular folk. You know, these are not college professors. They're not, you know, high-placed government officials. These are just regular working people who are trying to move ahead in life.
You know, I can feel your love of story, and you've certainly been involved in telling it in a lot of different mediums. So, when did you first want to be a writer?
Oh, gosh. You know, when I was young, I always thought I'd be a visual artist. You know, I was really drawn to art, but I didn't think I had enough original ideas. Mm. And then I didn't think I was just, you know, creative enough to do anything. The only thing I ever really wanted in life was to get out of my little small town and live an artistic life and have the respect of my peers. That's all I really wanted.
Mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished, you know. So it took me until I was I was an English major in college, for which I am daily grateful because it enriches my life so much. But my first creative venture into the world of creativity was as an actor. Back when I was about 25, I took an acting class, and then I was bitten by the acting bug, and I spent 10 or 12 years doing that. And then I really didn't go back to writing fiction. I mean, I was always writing as a profession. I was a nonprofit writer and, you know, writing grant proposals and press releases, because that was always a skill. I mean, I've always been a writer, but it wasn't until Michael and I suddenly had a family, and we had a mortgage, and we really couldn't do theater anymore, and I had to find a new creative outlet, so I pivoted to creative writing.
So you talk about, bringing historical incidents to light. You talk about seeing people, you know, and bringing cultures to different parts of the country. What is it about story, you think, that so captivates people and draws people to it? Because if people aren't reading, they're watching Netflix, right? Like, they're doing something. They're taking in story every day.
Yeah, narrative, man. Yeah. It is, you know, there's something really reassuring, I think, about narrative, even if it's dark and distressing, you know, because this is us, you know? Mm-hmm. Narrative, I mean, there is narrative of the planet and of the natural world, but narrative of human lives, that's what we're all about, you know? So I think reading beautiful language, I think there's something about the process of taking in language, taking in story, taking in the ways in which a writer can weave things together. It really is foundational to sort of human understanding.
I think the This Is Us is our podcast title. Right, I like right. that. That's really good.
And a show called that? A little copyright infringement.
That's right. We'll credit you. Oh. So I'm interested, you know, when you come to these stories, and even if it's based on nonfiction, you're still creating characters, right? You're still creating something. Where does this story come from? This is the one question I ask all my authors, because I'm really interested, and I hear some very different ideas. Where does this, it's a story plot, these characters, you said, you know, they're like visiting you, right?
Right.
Where does that come from?
Well, I mean, for me, it comes out of the connection to a character, you know, this personality, this human being who, as I mentioned, sort of visits you, and then what happens with them. The manuscript we're talking about, as I mentioned, I pulled a bunch of these characters from different dollar stories, but I was really worried about them because they were pretty lonely, a lot of them. They were striving, but things weren't really working out for them. So I decided I wanted to introduce them to each other. So the idea of pulling, it's a little bit like being a matchmaker, you know. So I pulled a bunch of people together, and I had to come up with a setting and a structure and a kind of tapestry that would put them all together. I think this concept of weaving the tapestry of different narratives is part of the writer's sort of modus operandi. Because I think there's a desire to help people along, you know, and you're helping your characters along, or for better or worse, you know, you're trying to get them to the next step.
Yeah, not in my books. I'm not helping them out at all.
That's true. There's a lot of high drama and conflict. You know?
Tell me about your process a little bit. And this is so different for everybody, too. You said it in the first book. You were doing it early. Do you write every day?
Oh, I don't write creatively every day. I write tons of emails and tons of, you know, promotional material. My process is pretty, you know, it is layered. And I write by hand, generally. Sometimes I write while I walk. You know, if I'm working on something, you know, I have a chunk of story that I'm working on, you know, or this character or that character, you know, if I've got a manuscript underway. So I tend to write in pencil, out loud, while I'm either walking or just sitting or something. Michael and I, my husband and I, go on these writing retreats, or I go to a place like Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, and just get away, and then I'm really immersed in it. Sometimes I dictate what I write into my phone, and transcribes it. But I often write in little snatches, you know, just little small chunks, and then the process is really putting these chunks together. You know, I as I said earlier, I tend to write in small sections, so it is much more of a, it's like collaging, really, because I've got all these little chunks. Some are backstory, some are present action. And then I've got to figure out how to put them together. So it's really much more of a quilting process.
Oh, that's great. When you have these little chunks, do they ever just not fit at the end?
Oh, sometimes they don't, yeah. You know, sometimes you can, quote, cannibalize something and make it something else, you know. So I'm having some fun with that first draft that I talked about and trying to cannibalize some of that. So, yeah, I mean, sometimes they never are resurrected, but sometimes they turn into something else.
So how long does that process take you? Because it sounds like your things are coming to you, you're writing little scenes, you're writing character notes, right, little moments, dialogue, whatever. How long does the whole process from start to finish, when you finally sit down to quilt, like, how long does that whole thing take before you have, like, something that's ready to go to an editor?
Well, it takes me years. I mean, I'm amazed at people who can crank out a new novel every year, but... So I'd say, you know, 2 or 3 years, something like that, to get all the chunks. And, you know, there's research, and depending on the content, you know, you do a deep kind of go down a rabbit hole on this piece of content or that piece of content. There's sharing it. There's feedback. Then there's doing what I think would be called a developmental edit. You know, when I was at VCCA, that's what I did. I took, you know, the whole manuscript in a big binder and went through it. And, you know, I have notes and post-it notes. And I mean, I'm sure people are much more organized. I mean, I have hundreds of little pages of notes, and I don't really get to them until way late in the process. And I go back and visit this section or that section and make notes and, you know, try to fix things that aren't working or try to make sure that things are continuous. You know, the continuity that the film people have, where you have a continuity editor. Mm-hmm. So to make sure, you know, you've got everybody who's the right age that they're supposed to be, and, you know, what kind of car were they driving out of this whole section about who was driving what kind of car, you know. So it takes me a long time. It took me, years to write my first novel. I mean, I was still raising kids, so I was really scrambling. But, you know, so I'm not trying to get something out there as quickly as possible. I mean, it just takes me a long time.
Is there something about when you're writing, like, with pencil and paper? So you said we do it when you're walking, right? Like,
yeah,
so
yeah, sometimes.
If you're not dictating, it sounds like a sort of awkward process. But is there something about that, like, tactile connection to the writing that helps you?
It absolutely does for me. I mean, I'm a digital immigrant, so, you know, the hard copy is kind of where I live. But and I like pencils, you know? I like the page and pencils, and you can scribble all over them and write on the front and the back and make little arrows here and there. So I like the graphic process of writing. And often I will speak as I write, you know, just to get the cadence right. So if I'm walking with my notebook, I'm also speaking. So you don't want to get too close, you know. But
that's a big part of the editing process, too, right? Speaking it out loud and, hearing
absolutely.
The sound of the words.
Absolutely. Even while you're composing, you know. I mean, that's definitely how I write. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of that comes out of my theater thing and the, you know, mm-hmm. speaking in the vernacular. But it's, you know, it isn't just the dialogue. I mean, it's description and exposition and all of that, you know. So there's a a whole kind of fluidity that I'm striving for. So you got to do that out loud.
And when you finally put all this together, are you doing it in like Word or Scrivener or some kind of processing?
Yeah, I just use Word, you know. I should maybe, I'm not systematic enough, I think, to use Scrivener, which is a kind of software program for writers. So I just use Word. And then, you know, turn it into a PDF or something to send it off to places.
But when you talk about like your structural edit and your developmental and you're looking for continuity and things, do you use any of the tools that are out there? There's like, you know, Notebook LM or Pro Writing Age or some of these things where you can just literally plug in your manuscript and ask it, you know?
I should, you know, I really should. It would make my life so much easier. I'm not tech phobic, but I am not super tech savvy. I mean, I find just the physical process of taking either handwritten things or typed things and having to import them, embed them, or retype them into some program, it's just a lot of typing. And I'm a fast typist, but something always happens on my laptop and the cursor jumps around and I have to get back to where I was.
I'll talk to you offline about this. All right, so I'm just curious. I've been asking a lot of writers about habit, and you know, there's writers who produce like you, and there's others who just don't and can never finish a project. Is there any tips that you have for developing the writing practice?
Oh, I would say just be dogged. Just don't give up. I mean, you just got to keep, even if it takes years, you know, just keep coming back to it, you know, inches. My image is that it's like a piece of cheese, like a real big round block of cheese, and you have to nibble at the edges and keep nibbling until you've eaten the entire block of cheese. You know, very like rodent kind of methodology.
Do you ever suffer from what people call writer's block, which I don't really believe in? Or moments when you're stuck, or is there anything you do, I guess, that ignites your creativity?
Yeah, I mean, getting out of town helps, you know. I think reading a lot. I read a lot. I read while I walk on the page, you know, when I go to the gym, I read while I'm... So I think immersing yourself in narrative really helps. You know, having fellowship with other writers, being able to, you know, actually talk through some of these technical writing challenges and to sort of get into that headset of, you know, because it's complicated. Writing is hard. It is just a really complex skill. So I would say, you know, immerse yourself in narrative and immerse yourself in kind of fellowship with others who are involved with narrative.
You've talked about the importance of community a number of times. Is that what inspired you to do the podcast?
Yeah, in many ways. I mean, Michael and I were talking. He was very concerned about just the polarization and the discord that we have in this country, and you know, really feeling like creativity is connective tissue. It is healing. It is connecting. It is rising beyond our petty grievances with each other. And that creativity is across the board. There's not just creativity for the, quote, you know, official artists, but creativity is in all walks of life. So that's what the podcast is we talk to people about the role creativity plays in shaping who they are.
I agree with every bit of that, and I love it. That's fantastic. So where should people go to find your work?
Well, I have a website, elizabethbrucedc.com. So there's everything you could possibly want to know about me in there. It's both a website and kind of an archive. The podcast is creativists.substack.com. So it's free for anybody who wants to sign up. We are also on Spotify. My two presses are Washington Writers Publishing House, which is, the website is washingtonwriters.org, and Vine Leaves Press is, I think, vineleavespress.com, I think. And those are the places you can find out about me. My long association in my teacher life, my educator life, was with a wonderful, large, complex, community-based organization called Centronia, CENTRONIA.org. So you can find out all about the good work they do there.
That's great. I always ask people if they would just go on Amazon and rate her book or leave a couple sentence reviews, because it makes a big difference for discoverability for people. And like 70% of all book sales are on Amazon, right? So it certainly helps. And if you like what we're doing here at Elaine's Literary Salon, please go to elainesliterarysalon.com. You can see our upcoming schedule. You can subscribe to our newsletter. And we would love a review for our restaurant. This has been really lovely.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Well done.
Fantastic questions.
Thank you. And you have some books up here, and you'll be signing, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay, wonderful. Looking forward to it. Thank you.